to hear about that, and all the places you've been. Do you think they'll ever find the way? The northern way to Asia, east or west? Yes. You and the Spanish block both southern routes, so we'll have to. Yes, we will. Or the Dutch. Why? And you've piloted the Barbary Coast, eh? Yes. Why? And you know Tripoli? Most pilots have been there. Why? I thought I'd seen you once. Yes, it was Tripoli. You were pointed out to me. The famous Inglés pilot, who went with the Dutch explorer, Kees Veerman, into the ice seas. And was once a captain with Drake, eh? At the Armada. How old were you then? 24. What were you doing in Tripoli? I was piloting an Inglés privateer. My ship had got taken in the Indies by this pirate, Morrow. Henry Morrow was his name. He burned my ship to the waterline after he'd sacked her and offered me the pilot's job. His man was useless, so he said. You know how it is. He wanted to go from there. We were watering off Hispaniola when he caught us. South along the main, then back across the Atlantic to try to intercept the annual Spanish gold ship near the Canaries. Then on through the Straits to Tripoli, if we missed her, to try for other prizes, then north again to England. He made the usual offer to free my comrades, give them food and boats in return if I joined them. I said, sure, why not? Providing we don't take any Portuguese shipping, and you put me ashore near Lisbon, and don't steal my rudders. We argued back and forth as usual. You know how it is. Then I swore by the Madonna, and we both swore on the cross, and that was that. We had a good voyage, and some fat Spanish merchantmen fell into our wake. When we were off Lisbon, he asked me to stay aboard, gave me the usual message from good Queen Bess, how she'd pay a princely bounty to any Portuguese pilot who'd join her, and teach others the skill at Trinity House, and give 5,000 guineas for the rudder of Magellan's Pass, or the Cape of Good Hope. His smile was broad, his teeth white and strong, and his dark moustache and beard well-groomed. I didn't have them. At least, that's what I told him. Morrow kept his word, like all pirates should. He put me ashore with my rudders. Of course, he'd had them copied, though he himself couldn't read or write. And he even gave me my share of the prize money. You ever sail with him, Inglés? No. The Queen knighted him a few years ago. I've never served on one of his ships. I'm glad he was fair with you. They were nearing Erasmus. Samurai were peering down at them quizzically. That was the second time I'd piloted for heretics. The first time I wasn't so lucky. Oh? Rodriguez shipped his oars, and the boat swerved neatly to the side, and he hung on to the boarding ropes. Go aloft, but leave the talking to me. Blackthorn began to climb, while the other pilot tied the boat safely. Rodriguez was the first on deck. He bowed like a courtier. Konnichiwa to all sod-eating samurais. There were four samurai on deck. Blackthorn recognized one of them as a guard of the trap door. Nonplussed, they bowed stiffly to the Portuguese. Blackthorn aped him, feeling awkward, and would have preferred to bow correctly. Rodriguez walked straight for the companionway. The seals were neatly in place. One of the samurai intercepted him.
Jinjiro, gomen nasai.
It's forbidden, so sorry.
Kinjiro, eh?
The Portuguese said, openly unimpressed.
I'm Rodrigo-san, Anjin for Toda Hiromatsu-sama. This seal, he said, pointing to the red stamp with the odd writing on it. Toda Hiromatsu-sama, ka?
Ie,
the samurai said, shaking his head.
Kashigi Yabu-sama.
Ie,
Rodriguez said.
Kashigi Yabu-sama?
I'm from Toda Hiromatsu-sama, who's a bigger king than your bugger, and Todi-sama's from Toranaga-sama, Who's the biggest bugger-sama in this whole world, ne?
He ripped the seal off the door, dropped a hand to one of his pistols. The swords were half out of their scabbards, and he said quietly to Blackthorn, "Get ready to abandon ship." And to the samurai he said gruffly,
"Toranaga-sama!"
He pointed with his left hand at the flag, which fluttered at his own masthead.
"Wakarimasuka?"
The samurai hesitated, their swords ready. Blackthorn prepared to dive over the side.
"Toranaga-sama!"
Rodriguez crashed his foot against the door. The latch snapped, and the door burst open.
"Wakarimasuka?"
"Wakarimasu, Anjin-san."
The samurai quickly put their swords away and bowed and apologized, and bowed again, and Rodriguez said hoarsely,
"That's better!"
and led the way below.
"Christ Jesus, Rodriguez,"
Blackthorn said when they were on the lower deck.
"Do you do this all the time and get away with it?"
"I do it very seldom,"
the Portuguese said, wiping the sweat from his brow.
"And even then, I wish I'd never started it."
Blackthorn leaned against the bulkhead.
"I feel as if someone's kicked me in the stomach."
"It's the only way. You've got to act like a king. Even so, you can never tell with a samurai. They're as dangerous as a pissed priest with a candle in his ass sitting on a half-full powder keg."
"What did you say to them?"
"Toda Hiramatsu is Toranaga's chief advisor. He's a bigger daimyo than this local one.
That's why they gave in."
"What's he like, Toranaga?"
"Long story, Ingles."
Rodriguez sat on the step, pulled his boot off, and rubbed his ankle.
"I nearly broke my foot on your lice-eaten door."
"It wasn't locked. You could have just opened it."
"I know, but that wouldn't have been as effective. By the Blessed Virgin, you've got a lot to learn."
"Will you teach me?"
Rodriguez pulled his boot back on.
"That depends," he said.
"On what?"
"We'll have to see, won't we? I've done all the talking so far, which is fair. I'm fit, you're not. Soon it'll be your turn. Which is your cabin?"
Blackthorn studied him for a moment. The smell below decks was stiff and weathered.
"Thanks for helping me come aboard."
He led the way aft. His door was unlocked. The cabin had been ransacked, and everything removable had been taken. There were no books or clothes or instruments or quills. His sea chest, too, was unlocked. And empty. White with rage, he walked into the great cabin, Rodriguez watching intently. Even the secret compartment had been found and looted.
"They've taken everything! The sons of plague-infested lice!"
"What did you expect?"
"I don't know. I thought, with the seals..."
Blackthorn went to the strongroom. It was bare. So was the magazine. The holds contained only the bales of woolen cloth.
"God curse all Jappers!"
He went back to his cabin and slammed his sea chest closed.
"Where are they?"
Rodriguez asked.
"What?"
"Your rudders. Where are your rudders?"
Blackthorn looked at him sharply.
"No pilot would worry about clothes. You came for the rudders, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"Why are you so surprised, Inglés? Why do you think I came aboard? To help you get more rags? They're threadbare as it is, and you'll need others. I've plenty for you. But where are the rudders?"
"They've gone. They were in my sea chest."
"I'm not going to steal them, Inglés. I just want to read them, and copy them, if need be. I'll cherish them like my own, so you've no need to worry."
His voice hardened.
"Please get them, Inglés. We've little time left."
"I can't. They've gone. They were in my sea chest."
"You wouldn't have left them there, not coming into a foreign port. You wouldn't forget a pilot's first rule, to hide them carefully and leave only false ones unprotected.
Hurry up!
They're stolen.
I don't believe you.
But I'll admit you've hidden them very well.
I searched for 2 hours and didn't get a fornicating whiff.
What?
Why are you so surprised, Inglés? Is your head up your ass? Naturally, I came here from Osaka to investigate your utters.
You've already been aboard?
Madonna! Rodriguez said impatiently. Yes, of course, 2 or 3 hours ago with Hiromatsu, who wanted to look around. He broke the seals, and then, when we left, this local daimyo sealed her up again. Hurry up, by God, he added. The sand's running out.
They're stolen!
Blackthorn told him how they had arrived, and how he had awakened ashore. Then he kicked his sea chest across the room, infuriated at the man who had looted his ship.
They're stolen. All my charts. All my rudders. I've copies of some in England, but my rudder of this voyage is gone, and the...
He stopped.
And the Portuguese rudder. Come on, Inglés. It had to be Portuguese.
Yes, and the Portuguese one. It's gone, too.
Get hold of yourself, he thought. They're gone, and that's the end.
Who has them?
The Japanese?
Or did they give them to the priest?
Without the rudders and the charts, you can't pilot your way home. You'll never get home.
That's not true. You can pilot your way home with care and enormous luck.
Don't be ridiculous. You're halfway around the earth, in enemy land, in enemy hands, and you've neither rudder nor charts.
Oh, Lord Jesus, give me strength.
Rodriguez was watching him intently. At length he said,
I'm sorry for you, Inglés. I know how you feel. It happened to me once. He was an Inglés, too, the thief. May his ship drown, and he burn in hell forever.
Come on, let's go back aboard.
Omin the others waited on the jetty until the galley rounded the headland and vanished. To the west, layers of night already etched the crimson sky. To the east, night joined the sky and the sea together, horizonless.
Mura, how long will it take to get all the cannon back on the ship?
If we work through the night, by midday tomorrow, Omi-san. If we begin at dawn, we'll be finished well before sunset. It would be safer to work during the day.
Work through the night. Bring the priest to the pit at once.
Omi glanced at Igarashi, Yabu's chief lieutenant, who was still looking out toward the headland, his face stretched, the livid scar tissue over his empty eye socket eerily shadowed.
You'd be welcome to stay, Igarashi-san. My house is poor, but perhaps we could make you comfortable.
Thank you,
the older man said, turning back to him.
But our master said to return to Edo at once, so I will return at once.
More of his concern showed.
I wish I was on that galley.
Yes.
I hate the thought of Yabu-sama being aboard with only 2 men. I hate it.
Yes.
He pointed at Erasmus.
A devil ship. That's what it is. So much wealth. Then nothing.
Surely everything. Won't Lord Torunaga be pleased? Enormously pleased with Lord Yabu's gift.
That money-infected province grabber is so filled with his own importance, he won't even notice the amount of silver he'll have stolen from our master. Where are your brains?
I presume only your anxiety over the possible danger to our lord prompted you to make such a remark.
You're right, Omi-san. No insult was intended. You've been very clever and helpful to our master. Perhaps you're right about Torunaga, too,
Igarashi said. But he was thinking.
Enjoy your newfound wealth, you poor fool. I know my master better than you, and your increased fief
will do you no good at all. Your advancement would have been a fair return for the ship, the bullion, and the arms. But now they've vanished. And because of you, my master's in jeopardy. You sent the message, and you said, see the barbarians first, tempting him. We should have left yesterday. Yes, then my master would have been safely away by now, with the money and arms. Are you a traitor? Are you acting for yourself, or your stupid father, or for an enemy? For Toranaga, perhaps. It doesn't matter. You can believe me, Omi, you dung-eating young fool. You and your branch of the Kashigi clan are not long for this earth. I'd tell you to your face, but then I'd have to kill you, and I would have spurned my master's trust. He's the one to say when, not me. Thank you for your hospitality, Omi-san, he said. I'll look forward to seeing you soon, but I'll be on my way now.
Would you do something for me, please? Give my respects to my father? I'd appreciate it very much.
I'd be happy to. He's a fine man. And I haven't congratulated you yet on your new fief.
You're too kind.
Thank you again, Omi-san.
He raised his hand in friendly salutation, motioned to his men, and led the phalanx of horsemen out of the village. Omi went to the pit. The priest was there. Omi could see the man was angry, and he hoped that he would do something overt, publicly, so he could have him thrashed.
Priest, tell the barbarians they are to come up, one by one. Tell them Lord Yabu has said they may live again in the world of men.
Omi kept his language deliberately simple.
But the smallest breaking of a rule, and two will be put back into the pit. They are to behave and obey all orders. Is that clear?
Yes.
Omi made the priest repeat it to him as before. When he was sure the man had it all correctly, he made him speak it down into the pit. The men came up, one by one. All were afraid. Some had to be helped. One man was in great pain and screamed every time someone touched his arm.
There should be nine.
One is dead. His body is down there. In the pit, the priest said.
Omi thought for a moment.
Mura, burn the corpse and keep the ashes with those of the other barbarian. Put these men in the same house as before. Give them plenty of vegetables and fish, and barley soup and fruit. Have them washed. They stink. Priest, tell them that if they behave and obey, the food will continue.
Omi watched and listened carefully. He saw them all react gratefully, and he thought with contempt,
How stupid! I deprive them for only 2 days, then give them back a pittance, and now they'll eat dung. They really will.
Mura, make them bow properly, and take them away!
Then he turned to the priest.
Well?
I go now. Go my home. Leave Anjiro.
Better you leave and stay away forever. You and every priest like you.
Perhaps the next time one of you comes into my fief, it is because some of my Christian peasants or vassals are considering treason,
he said, using the veiled threat and classic ploy that anti-Christian samurai used to control the indiscriminate spread of the foreign dogma in their fiefs. For though foreign priests were protected, their Japanese converts were not.
Christians, good Japanese, always, only good vassals, never had bad thoughts, no.
I'm glad to hear it. Don't forget my fief stretches 20 li in every direction. Do you understand?
I understand. Yes, I understand very well.
He watched the man bow stiffly. Even barbarian priests had to have manners, and walk away.
Omi-san?
One of his samurai said. He was young and very handsome.
Yes?
Please excuse me. I know you haven't forgotten, but Masijiro-san is still in the pit.
Omi went to the trap door and stared down at the samurai. Instantly, the man was on his knees, bowing deferentially. The 2 days had aged him. Omi weighed his past service and his future worth. Then he took the young samurai's dagger from his sash and dropped it into the pit. At the bottom of the ladder, Masijiro stared at the knife in disbelief. Tears began coursing his cheeks.
"I don't deserve this honor, Omi-san,"
he said abjectly.
"Yes. Thank you."
The young samurai beside Omi said,
"May I please ask that he be allowed to commit seppuku here, on the beach?"
"He failed in the pit. He stays in the pit. Order the villagers to fill it in. Obliterate all traces of it. The barbarians have defiled it."
Kiku laughed and shook her head.
"No, Omi-san, so sorry. Please, no more sake for me, or my hair will fall down. I'll fall down, and then where would we be?"
"I'd fall down with you, and we'd pillow, and be in nirvana, outside ourselves,"
Omi said happily, his head swimming from the wine.
"Ah, but I'd be snoring, and you can't pillow a snoring, horrid, drunken girl and get much pleasure." "Certainly not. So sorry." "Oh, no. Omi-sama of the huge new fief, you deserve better than that."
She poured another thimble of the warm wine into the tiny porcelain cup and offered it with both hands, her left forefinger and thumb delicately holding the cup, the forefinger of her right hand touching the underside.
"Here, because you are wonderful."
He accepted it and sipped, enjoying its warmth and mellow tang.
"I'm so glad I was able to persuade you to stay an extra day, ne? You are so beautiful, Kiku-san."
"You are beautiful, and it is my pleasure."
Her eyes were dancing in the light of a candle, encased in a paper and bamboo flower that hung from the cedar rafter. This was the best suite of rooms in the tea house near the square. She leaned over to help him to some more rice from the simple wooden bowl that was on the low black lacquered table in front of him. But he shook his head.
"No, no, thank you."
"You should eat more, a strong man like you."
"I'm full, really."
He did not offer her any because she had barely touched her small salad, thinly sliced cucumbers and tiny sculptured radishes pickled in sweet vinegar, which was all she would accept of the whole meal. There had been slivers of raw fish on balls of tacky rice, soup, the salad, and some fresh vegetables served with a piquant sauce of soya and ginger. And rice. She clapped her hands softly and the shoji was opened instantly by her personal maid.
"Yes, mistress. Shuisen, take all these things away and bring more sake and a fresh pot of cha. And fruit. The sake should be warmer than last time. Hurry up, good for nothing."
She tried to sound imperious. Suisen was 14, sweet, anxious to please, and an apprentice courtesan. She had been with Kiku for 2 years, and Kiku was responsible for her training. With an effort, Kiku took her eyes off the pure white rice that she would have loved to have eaten and dismissed her own hunger.
"You ate before you arrived, and you will eat later," she reminded herself. "Yes, but even then, it was so little." "Ah, but ladies have tiny appetites, very tiny appetites," her teacher used to say. "Guests eat and drink, the more the better. Ladies don't, and certainly never with guests. How can ladies talk or entertain or play the samisen or dance if they're stuffing their mouths? You will eat later. Be patient. Concentrate on your guest."
While she watched Suisen critically, gauging her skill, she told Omi stories to make him laugh and forget the world outside. The young girl knelt beside Omi, tidied the small bowls and chopsticks on the lacquer tray into a pleasing pattern, as she had been taught. Then she picked up the empty sake flask, poured to make sure it was empty. It would have been very bad manners to have shaken the flask. Then got up with the tray, noiselessly carried it to the shoji door, knelt, put the tray down, opened the shoji, got up, stepped through the door, knelt again, lifted the tray out, put it down again as noiselessly, and closed the door completely.
"I'll really have to get another maid,"
Kiku said, not displeased.
"That colour suits her," she was thinking. "I must send to Edo for some more of that silk. What a shame it's so expensive. Never mind, with all the money Gyoko-san was given for last night and tonight, there will be more than enough from my share to buy little Suisen 20 kimonos. She's such a sweet child, and really very graceful. She makes so much noise, it disturbs the whole room. So sorry."
"I didn't notice her. Only you," Omi said, finishing his wine.
Kiku fluttered her fan, her smile lighting her face.
"You make me feel very good, Omi-san. Yes, and beloved."
Suisen brought the sake quickly, and the char. Her mistress poured Omi some wine and gave it to him. The young girl unobtrusively filled the cups. She did not spill a drop, and she thought the sound that the liquid made going into the cup had the right quiet kind of ring to it. So she sighed inwardly with vast relief, sat back on her heels, and waited. Kiku was telling an amusing story that she had heard from one of her friends in Mishima, and Omi was laughing. As she did so, she took one of the small oranges, and using her long fingernails, opened it as though it were a flower, the sections of the fruit, the petals, the divisions of the skin, its leaves. She removed a fleck of pith and offered it with both hands, as if this were the usual way a lady would serve the fruit to her guest.
"Would you like an orange, Omi-san?"
Omi's first reaction was to say,
"I can't destroy such beauty, but that would be inept," he thought, dazzled by her artistry. "How can I compliment her and her unnamed teacher? How can I return the happiness that she has given me, letting me watch her fingers create something so precious, yet so ephemeral?"
He held the flower in his hands for a moment, then nimbly removed four sections, equidistant from each other, and ate them with enjoyment. This left a new flower. He removed four more sections, creating a third floral design. Next, he took one section and moved a second so that the remaining three made still another blossom. Then he took two sections and replaced the last in the orange cradle, in the center, on its side, as though a crescent moon within a sun. He ate one very slowly. When he had finished, he put the other in the center of his hand and offered it.
"This you must have, because it is the second to last. This is my gift to you."
Suisen could hardly breathe.
"What was the last one for?"
Kiku took the fruit and ate it. It was the best she had ever tasted.
"This, the last one,"
Omi said, putting the whole flower gravely into the palm of his right hand.
"This is my gift to the gods, whoever they are, wherever they are. I will never eat this fruit again, unless it is from your hands."
"That is too much, Omi-sama," Kiku said. "I release you from your vow. That was said under the influence of the kami who lives in all sake bottles."
"I refuse to be released."
They were very happy together.
"Suisen,"
she said,
"now leave us. And please, child, please try to do it with grace." "Yes, mistress."
The young girl went into the next room and checked that the futons were meticulous, the love instruments and pleasure beads near at hand, and the flowers perfect. An imperceptible crease was smoothed from the already smooth cover. Then, satisfied, Suisen sat down, sighed with relief, fanned the heat out of her face with her lilac fan, and contentedly waited. In the next room, which was the finest of all the rooms in the tea house, the only one with a garden of its own, Kiku picked up the long-handled samisen. It was three-stringed, guitar-like, and Kiku's first soaring chord filled the room. Then she began to sing. At first soft, then trilling. Soft again, then louder. Softer and sighing sweetly, ever sweetly. She sang of love and unrequited love, and happiness and sadness.
Mistress!
The whisper would not have awakened the lightest sleeper. But Suisan knew that her mistress preferred not to sleep after the clouds and the rain, however strong. She preferred to rest, half awake in tranquility.
Yes, sweet Chan?
Kika whispered as quietly, using Chan as one would to a favourite child.
Omisan's wife has returned. Her palanquin has just gone up the path to his house.
Kiku glanced at Omi. His neck rested comfortably on the padded wooden pillow, arms interlocked. His body was strong and unmarked, his skin firm and golden, a sheen there. She caressed him gently, enough to make the touch enter his dream, but not enough to awaken him. Then she slid from under the quilt, gathering her kimonos around herself. It took Kiku very little time to renew her makeup as Suizen combed and brushed her hair, and retied it into the Shimoda style. Then mistress and maid walked noiselessly along the corridor, out onto the veranda, through the garden to the square. Boats, like fireflies, plied from the barbarian ship to the jetty, where seven of the cannons still remained to be loaded. It was still deep night, long before dawn. The two women slipped along the narrow path between a cluster of houses and began to climb the path. Sweat-stained and exhausted bearers were collecting their strength around the palanquin on the hilltop outside Omi's house. Kiku did not knock on the garden door. Candles were lit in the house, and servants were hurrying to and fro. She motioned to Suizen, who immediately went to the veranda near the front door, knocked, and waited. In a moment, the door opened. The maid nodded and vanished. Another moment and the maid returned and beckoned Kiku and bowed low as she swept past. Another maid scurried ahead and opened the shoji of the best room. Omi's mother's bed was unslept in. She was sitting, rigidly erect, near the small alcove that held the flower arrangement. A small window shoji was open to the garden. Midori, Omi's wife, was opposite her. Kiku knelt.
Is it only a night ago that I was here and terrified on the night of the screams?
She bowed, first to Omi's mother, then to his wife, feeling the tension between the two women. And she asked herself,
why is it there is always such violence between mother-in-law and daughter-in-law? Doesn't daughter-in-law, in time, become mother-in-law? Why does she then always treat her own daughter-in-law to a lashing tongue and make her life a misery? And why does that girl do the same in her turn? Doesn't anyone learn? I'm sorry to disturb you, Mistress-san.
You're very welcome, Kiku-san,
the old woman replied.
There's no trouble, I hope.
Oh, no, but I didn't know whether or not you'd want me to awaken your son,
she said to her, already knowing the answer.
I thought I'd better ask you, as you, Midori-san.
She turned and smiled and bowed slightly to Midori, liking her greatly.
As you had returned.
The old woman said,
you're very kind, Kiku-san, and very thoughtful. No, leave him in peace.
Very well. Please excuse me, disturbing you like this, but I thought it best to ask. Midori-san, I hope your journey was not too bad. So sorry. It was awful,
Midori said.
I'm glad to be back and hated being away. Is my husband well? Yes, very well. He laughed a lot this evening and seemed to be happy. He ate and drank sparingly, and he's sleeping soundly. The mistress-san was beginning to tell me some of the terrible things that happened while I was away, and... You shouldn't have gone. You were needed here.
The old woman interrupted, venom in her voice.
Or perhaps not. Perhaps you should have stayed away permanently. Perhaps you brought a bad kami into our house, along with your bed linen. I'd never do that, Mistress-san, Midori said patiently. Please believe, I would rather kill myself than bring the slightest stain to your good name. Please forgive my being away and my faults. I'm sorry. Since that devil ship came here, we've had nothing but trouble. That's bad, Kami. Very bad. And where were you when you were needed? Gossiping in Mishima, stuffing yourself and drinking sake. My father died, Mistress-san, the day before I arrived. Huh. You haven't even got the courtesy or the foresight to be at your own father's deathbed. The sooner you permanently leave our house, the better for all of us. I want some cha. We have a guest here, and you haven't even remembered your manners enough to offer her refreshment. It was ordered instantly, the moment she... It hasn't arrived instantly.
The shoji opened. A maid nervously brought cha and some sweet cakes. First Midori served the old woman, who cursed the maid roundly and chomped toothlessly on her cake, slurping her drink.
You must excuse the maid, Kiku-san, the old woman said. The cha's tasteless. Tasteless! And scalding. I suppose that's only to be expected in this house. Here, please have mine.
Midori blew gently on the tea to cool it. The old woman took it grudgingly.
Why can't it be correct the first time?
She lapsed into sullen silence.
What do you think about all this?
Midori asked Kiku.
The ship, and Yabu-sama, and Todahiro Matsu-sama. I don't know what to think. As to the barbarians, who knows? They're certainly an extraordinary collection of men. And the great daimyo, Iron Fist? It's very curious that he arrived almost the same time as Lord Yabu, eh? Well, you must excuse me. No, please. I can see myself out. Oh, no, Kiku-san. I wouldn't hear of it. There! You see, Midori-san?
The old woman interrupted impatiently.
Our guests uncomfortable, and the cha awful. Oh, the cha was sufficient for me, Mistress-san. Really? Now, if you'll excuse me, I am a little tired. Perhaps before I go tomorrow, I may be allowed to come to see you. It's always such a pleasure to talk with you.
The old woman allowed herself to be cajoled, and Kiku followed Midori onto the veranda and into the garden.
Kiku-san, you're so thoughtful,
Midori said, holding her arm, warmed by her beauty.
It was very kind of you. Thank you.
Kiku glanced back at the house momentarily and shivered.
Is she always like that? Tonight, she was polite, compared to sometimes. If it wasn't for Omi and my son, I swear I'd shake her dust off my feet, shave my head, and become a nun. But I have Omi and my son, and that makes up for everything. I only thank all Kami for that. Fortunately, Mistress-san prefers Edo and can't stay away from there for very long.
Midori smiled sadly.
You train yourself not to listen. You know how it is.
She sighed, so beautiful in the moonlight.
But that's unimportant. Tell me what's happened since I left.
This was why Kiku had come to the house so urgently, for obviously neither the mother nor the wife would wish Omi's sleep disturbed. She came to tell the lovely Lady Midori everything, so she could help to guard Kashigi Omi as she herself would try to guard him. She told her all that she knew, except what had happened in the room with Yabu. She added the rumors she had heard and the stories the other girls had passed on to her or invented. And everything that Omi had told her, his hopes and fears and plans, everything about him, except what had happened in the room tonight. She knew that this was not important to his wife.
I'm afraid, Kiku-san. Afraid for my husband. Everything he advised was wise, lady. I think everything he did was correct. Lord Yabu doesn't reward anyone lightly, and 3,000 koku is a worthy increase. But the ship's Lord Taranaga's now, and all that money. Yes, but for Yabu-sama to offer the ship as a gift was an idea of genius. Omi-san gave the idea to Yabu. Surely this itself is payment enough, ne? Omi-san must be recognized as a preeminent vassal.
Kiku twisted the truth just a trifle, knowing that Omi was in great danger, and all his house.
What is to be, will be,
she reminded herself.
But it does no harm to ease the brow of a nice woman. Yes, I can see that,
Midori said.
Let it be the truth,
she prayed.
Please let it be the truth.
She embraced the girl, her eyes filling with tears.
Thank you. You're so kind, Kiku-san. So kind.
She was 17. Chapter 8.
What do you think, Inglés?
I think there'll be a storm.
When?
Before sunset.
It was near noon, and they were standing on the quarterdeck of the galley under a grey overcast. This was the second day out to sea.
If this was your ship, what would you do?
How far is it to our landfall?
Blackthorn asked.
After sunset?
How far to the nearest land?
4 or 5 hours, Inglés. But to run for cover will cost us half a day, and I can't afford that. What would you do?
Blackthorn thought a moment. During the first night, the galley had sped southward down the east coast of the Izu Peninsula, helped by the large sail on the midship's mast. When they had come abreast of the southmost cape, Cape Ito, Rodriguez had set the course west-southwest and had left the safety of the coast for the open sea, heading for a landfall at Cape Shinto, 200 miles away.
Normally, in one of these galleys, we'd hug the coast, for safety,
Rodriguez had said.
But that'd take too much time, and time is important. Torunaga asked me to pilot Todi to Anjiro and back. Quickly. There's a bonus for me, if we're very quick. One of their pilots would be just as good on a short haul like this. But the poor son of a whore would be frightened to death, carrying so important a daimyo as Todi, particularly out of sight of land. They're not oceaners, Jap men. Great pirates and fighters and coastal sailors, but the deep frightens them. The old Taiko even made a law that the few ocean ships Japmen possess were always to have Portuguese pilots aboard. It's still the law of their land today.
Why did he do that? Rodriguez shrugged.
Perhaps someone suggested it to him.
Who?
Your stolen rata, Inglés, the Portuguese one. Whose was it?
I don't know. There was no name on it, no signature.
Where'd you get it?
From the chief merchant of the Dutch East India Company.
Where'd he get it from?
Blackthorn shrugged. Rodriguez's laugh had no humor in it.
Well, I never expected you to tell me. But whoever stole it and sold it, I hope he burns in hellfire forever.
You're employed by this Torunaga, Rodriguez?
No. I was just visiting Osaka, my captain and I. This was just a favor to Torunaga. My captain volunteered me. I'm pilot of the...
Rodriguez had stopped.
I keep forgetting you're the enemy, Inglés.
Portugal and England have been allies for centuries.
But we're not now. Go below, Inglés. You're tired, and so am I, and tired men make mistakes. Come on deck when you're rested.
So Blackthorn had gone below to the pilot's cabin and had lain on the bunk. Rodriguez's rudder of the voyage was on the sea desk, which was pinned to the bulkhead like the pilot's chair on the quarterdeck. The book was leather-covered and used, but Blackthorn did not open it.
Why leave it there? He had asked previously.
If I didn't, you'd search for it. But you won't touch it there, or even look at it, uninvited. You're a pilot, not a pig-bellied, whoring, thieving merchant or soldier.
I'll read it. You would.
Not uninvited, Inglés. No pilot would do that. Even I wouldn't.
Blackthorn had watched the book for a moment, and then he closed his eyes. He slept deeply, all of that day and part of the night. It was just before dawn when he awoke, as always. It took time to adjust to the untoward motion of the galley and the throb of the drum that kept the oars moving as one. He lay comfortably on his back in the dark, his arms under his head. He thought about his own ship and put away his worry of what would happen when they reached shore and Osaka. One thing at a time. Think about Felicity and Tudor and home. No, not now. Think that if other Portuguese are like Rodriguez, you've a good chance now. You'll get a ship home. Pilots are not enemies, and the pox on other things. But you can't say that, lad. You're English, the hated heretic and antichrist. Catholics own this world. They owned it. Now we and the Dutch are going to smash them. What nonsense it all is. Catholic and Protestant and Calvinist and Lutherist and every other shitist. You should have been born Catholic. It was only fate that took your father to Holland, where he met a woman, Annika van Droste, who became his wife, and he saw Spanish Catholics and Spanish priests and the Inquisition for the first time. I'm glad he had his eyes opened, Blackthorn thought. I'm glad mine are open. Then he had gone on deck. Rodriguez was in his chair, his eyes red-rimmed with sleeplessness, two Japanese sailors on the helm as before. Can I take this watch for you?
How do you feel, Inglés?
Rested. Can I take the watch for you? Blackthorn saw Rodriguez measuring him. I'll wake you if the wind changes. Anything.
Thank you, Inglés. Yes, I'll sleep a little. Maintain this course. At the turn, go 4 degrees more westerly, and at the next, 6 more westerly. You'll have to point the new course on the compass for the helmsman. Wakarimasuka?
Hi! Blackthorn laughed. 4 points westerly it is. Go below, pilot. Your bunk's comfortable.
But Vasco Rodriguez did not go below. He merely pulled his sea cloak closer and settled deeper into the sea chair. Just before the turn of the hourglass, he awoke momentarily and checked the course change without moving, and immediately went back to sleep again. Once when the wind veered, he awoke, and then, when he had seen there was no danger, again he slept. Hiromatsu and Yabu came on deck during the morning. Blackthorn noticed their surprise that he was conning the ship and Rodriguez sleeping. They did not talk to him, but returned to their conversation, and later they went below again. Near midday, Rodriguez had risen from the sea chair to stare northeast, sniffing the wind, all his senses concentrated. Both men studied the sea and the sky and the encroaching clouds.
What would you do, Inglés, if this was your ship? Rodriguez said again.
I'd run for the coast if I knew where it was. The nearest point. This craft won't take much water, and there's a storm there, all right. About 4 hours away.
Can't be typhoon,
Rodriguez muttered.
What? Typhoon. They're huge winds. The worst storms you've ever seen. But we're not in typhoon season.
When's that?
It's not now, enemy.
Rodriguez laughed.
No, not now. But it could be rotten enough, so I'll take your piss-cutting advice.
Steer north by west.
As Blackthorn pointed the new course and the helmsman turned the ship neatly, Rodriguez went to the rail and shouted at the captain,
Isogi, Captain-san! Wakarimasuka?
Isogi! Hai!
What's that? Hurry up!
The corners of Rodriguez's eyes crinkled with amusement.
No harm in you knowing a little Japman talk, eh? Sure, Inglés. Isogi means to hurry. All you need here is about 10 words, and then you can make the bugger shit if you want to. If they're the right words, of course, and if they're in the mood. I'll go below now and get some food.
You cook, too?
In Japland, every civilized man has to cook, or personally has to train one of the monkeys to cook, or you starve to death. All they eat's raw fish, raw vegetables and sweet pickle vinegar. But life here can be a piss cutter, if you know how.
Is piss cutter good or bad?
It's mostly very good, but sometimes terribly bad. It all depends how you feel. And you ask too many questions.
Rodriguez went below. He barred his cabin door and carefully checked the lock on his sea chest. The hair that he had placed so delicately was still there, and a similar hair, equally invisible to anyone but him, that he had put on the cover of his rotter, was also untouched.
You can't be too careful in this world, Rodriguez thought. Is there any harm in his knowing that you're the pilot of the Nau del Trato, this year's great black ship from Macau? Perhaps, because then you'd have to explain that she's a Leviathan, one of the richest, biggest ships in the world, more than 1,600 tons. You might be tempted to tell him about her cargo, about trade, and about Macau, and all sorts of illuminating things that are very, very private, and very, very secret. But we are at war, us against the English and the Dutch.
He opened the well-oiled lock and took out his private rudder to check some bearings for the nearest haven, and his eyes saw the sealed packet the priest, Father Sebastião, had given him just before they had left Anjiro.
Does it contain the Englishman's letters?
He asked himself again. He weighed the package and looked at the Jesuit seals, sorely tempted to break them and see for himself. Blackthorn had told him that the Dutch squadron had come by way of Magellan's Pass and little else.
The Inglés asks lots of questions and volunteers nothing, Rodriguez thought. He's shrewd, clever, and dangerous. Are they his rudders, or aren't they? If they are, what good are they to the Holy Fathers?
He shuddered, thinking of Jesuits and Franciscans and Dominicans, and all monks and all priests, and the Inquisition.
There are good priests and bad priests, and they're mostly bad, but they're still priests. The Church has to have priests, and without them to intercede for us, we lost sheep in a satanic world. Oh, Madonna, protect me from all evil and bad priests.
Rodriguez had been in his cabin with Blackthorn in Anjiro Harbour when the door had opened and Father Sebastião had come in uninvited. They had been eating and drinking, and the remains of their food was in the wooden bowls.
You break bread with heretics?
The priest had asked.
It's dangerous to eat with them. They're infectious. Did he tell you he's a pirate? It's only Christian to be chivalrous to your enemies, Father. When I was in their hands, they were fair to me. I only returned their charity.
He had knelt and kissed the priest's cross. Then he had got up, and offering wine, he said,
How can I help you? I want to go to Osaka, with the ship. I'll ask them at once.
He had gone and had asked the captain, and the request had gradually gone up to Toda Hiramatsu, who replied that Toranaga had said nothing about bringing a foreign priest from Anjiro, so he regretted he could not bring the foreign priest from Anjiro. Father Sebastião had wanted to talk privately, so he had sent the Englishman on deck, and then, in the privacy of the cabin, the priest had brought out the sealed package.
I would like you to deliver this to the Father Visitor.
I don't know if His Eminence will still be at Osaka when I get there.
Rodriguez did not like being a carrier of Jesuit secrets.
I might have to go back to Nagasaki. My Captain General may have left orders for me. Then give it to Father Alvito. Make absolutely sure you put it only in his hands.
Very well, he had said.
When were you last at confession, my son?
On Sunday, Father.
Would you like me to confess you now?
Yes, thank you.
He was grateful that the priest had asked, for you never knew if your life depended on the sea, and afterwards he had felt much better as always. Now in the cabin, Rodriguez put back the package, greatly tempted.
Why, Father Alvito?
Father Martin Alvito was chief trade negotiator and had been personal interpreter for the Taiko for many years, and therefore an intimate of most of the influential daimyos. Father Alvito plied between Nagasaki and Osaka, and was one of the very few men, and the only European, who had access to the Taiko at any time. An enormously clever man who spoke perfect Japanese and knew more about them and their way of life than any man in Asia. Now he was the Portuguese's most influential mediator to the Council of Regents, and to Ishido and Toranaga in particular.
Trust the Jesuits to get one of their men into such a vital position,
Rodriguez thought with awe.
Certainly, if it hadn't been for the Society of Jesus, the flood of heresy would never have been stopped. Portugal and Spain might have gone Protestant, and we'd have lost our immortal souls forever. Madonna! Why do you think about priests all the time?
Rodriguez asked himself aloud.
You know it makes you nervous.
Yes, even so. Why, Father Alvito? If the package contains the rutters, is the package meant for one of the Christian daimyos? Or Ishido, or Toranaga? Or just for His Eminence, the Father Visitor himself? Or for my Captain General? Or will the rutters be sent to Rome, for the Spaniards?
Why, Father Alvito? Father Sebastião could have easily said to give it to one of the other Jesuits. And why does Toranaga want the Inglés?
In my heart, I know I should kill Blackthorn. He's the enemy. He's a heretic. But there's something else. I've a feeling this Inglés is a danger to all of us. Why should I think that? He's a pilot. A great one. Strong. Intelligent. A good man. Nothing there to worry about.
So why am I afraid? Is he evil? I like him very much, but I feel I should kill him quickly, and the sooner the better. Not in anger, just to protect ourselves. Why?
I am afraid of him.
What to do?
Leave it to the hand of God?
The storm's coming, and it'll be a bad one. God curse me and my lack of wits. Why don't I know what to do easily?
The storm came before sunset and caught them out to sea. Land was 10 miles away. The bay they raced for was haven enough and dead ahead when they had crested the horizon. There were no shoals or reefs to navigate between them and safety. But 10 miles was 10 miles, and the sea was rising fast, driven by the rain-soaked wind. The gale blew from the northeast on the starboard quarter, and veered badly as gusts swirled easterly or northerly, without pattern, the sea grim. Their course was northwest, so they were mostly broadside to the swell, rolling badly, now in the trough, now sickeningly on the crest. The galley was shallow draft and built for speed and kind waters, and though the rowers were game and very disciplined, it was hard to keep their oars in the sea and their pool clean.
You have to ship the oars and run before the wind,
Blackthorn shouted.
Maybe, but not yet. Where are your cojones, Inglés? Where they should be, by God, and where I want them to stay.
Both men knew that if they turned into the wind, they could never make way against the storm, so the tide and the wind would take them away from sanctuary and out to sea. And if they ran before the wind, the tide and the wind would take them away from sanctuary and out to sea as before, only faster. Southward was the great deep. There was no land southward for 1,000 miles, or, if you were unlucky, for 1,000 leagues. They wore lifelines that were lashed to the binnacle, and they were glad of them as the deck pitched and rolled. They hung on to the gunwales as well, riding her. As yet, no water had come aboard. She was heavily laden and rode lower in the water than either would have liked. Rodriguez had prepared properly in the hours of waiting. Everything had been battened down, the men forewarned. Hiromatsu and Yabu had said that they would stay below for a time and then come on deck. Rodriguez had shrugged and told them clearly that it would be very dangerous.
He was sure they did not understand.
"What'll they do?"
Blackthorn had asked.
"Who knows?"